Boker Tov, everybody. Let's get started. Perkei Avot. We're up to Perek Gimel, Mishnah Gimel. Actually, we're in the middle of Mishnah Beit, I believe. No. We're up to Mishnah Gimel. We spoke last week about, we ended off, you have to pray for the welfare of the government and the Canadian government, the U.S. government, the Russian government, even the Tsar, and because anarchy is worse than anything. And then the idea of two people who sit together, they have to learn Torah. Ein Torah b'nehem. When we discuss the very fascinating idea, it's not enough. It's not just the idea that two people who are sitting should be discussing matters of Torah. It's that the Torah should interact between them. Yesh Torah b'nehem. If one person sits in a corner and learn and another person sits in the corner and learn, they're in the same Beit Midrash, but they have no connection, that's very bad. The only way we grow is by hearing other ideas, and we know the classical way of Jewish learning is you learn with a chevruta. This way, I don't think we said last week that the Gemara has a play on words, on the word oyev and ohev. Oyev is an enemy, and ohev is a person you love, a beloved person. So the Talmud says that when two people study Torah, they should be enemies one another. The idea of studying is to think how to critique the other person. You know, Tosva takes a look at Rashi and what don't they like about Rashi. And by critiquing, by having what we would call in politics a strong opposition, you get to the truth much more. When you argue with each other, to sit and learn on your own, you're not going to grow in learning. So that's what the second part, two people learning, they learn together. So first, when we study, we're oybim, we're sort of not enemies in the, you know, in the physical sense, but enemies intellectually. And then we become beloved because each one helps the other. Okay, so continuing on this theme a little bit, Mishnah Gimel, Rabbi Shimon Omer, Perek Gimel, Mishnah Gimel, Perkei Avot, Shloshash Achlu al Shulchan Achad, V'lo Amru Alav Divrei Torah. Three people who are sitting on one table. So there apparently there's something special when you're eating a meal. Lo amru alav divrei Torah, and they're sitting and eating, and they don't say any words of Torah. Ki ilu achlu mizivchei meitim. It's as if they're eating from the zivchei meitim, the sacrifices of the dead. So what does that mean? So many of the commentaries explain sacrifices of the dead, idolatry. This is an idolatrous idea. Now the word ki'ilu, which we're going to get in the next Mishnah too later on. The word ke'ilu is a very important word in rabbinic literature. It means it's like. It doesn't mean it's the same thing. For example, it's one of the most famous examples is if you embarrass somebody, it's as if you killed them, right? It's ke'ilu shofech damim. And we know when you publicly, when you embarrass a person, they turn red. That's like bleeding. Then they turn white. They lose their blood. That's the idea that you've basically, the Talmud says, it's as if you killed them. It doesn't mean you killed them. It's not the same thing as murder. It's ke'ilu. So we're going to see that comes up a lot. So the Talmud, it's as if. How can three people eat? And so it's as if it's idolatry. It's not quite idolatry. That's one idea. Zivchei Meitim also means, of course, that when a person dies, you can't bring a sacrifice on their behalf. In other words, if a person wants to bring a sacrifice to the temple, and he dies before he gets the chance to bring it, the children don't bring it. The children don't bring the sacrifice to so zivchei meitim. In other words, when we eat, what's the idea of the Mishnah? We all know it's a very basic idea that our everything we do, our eating, should be a holy activity, right? Rav Soloveitchik explains the way animals eat and the way human beings eat. You know, animals eat on their own and they grab and they whenever they want, right? We human beings, we have a whole system how to eat, even in the non-Jewish world. There's etiquette and how things are served, and the way it's presented is often more important than the food itself. So the idea of gathering together for a meal is not only to eat, it's for some additional purposes. And the Mishnah says you have to say words of Torah when you eat. That's very nice. How many people actually do that? How many people every night when they eat with their family have Divrei Torah at this table? I don't know. I don't know exactly. Maybe that's a problem. The Bartanura says it's a very difficult stretch, but the Bartanura says when you say Birchat HaMazon on eating, that counts. In other words, what he's saying really is you shouldn't just eat because you're hungry. You should acknowledge God. And in Birchat HaMazon, of course, we acknowledge God. I don't think that's really the plain meaning of the Mishnah, but he says we fulfill our obligation by Birchat HaMazon. I've often mentioned that I don't understand that. Maybe, I don't know if, I know when growing up, and I went to all the weddings I went to in New York, so the custom in New York is nobody says, you know, speeches at a wedding, right? Is that still the custom in many circles? People don't speak. You come to a wedding. I've never understood it because the whole thing doesn't make any sense. So you're spending, or the way it used to be, people spend $100,000 on a wedding, invite 500 people, and nobody says a word. Nobody welcomes you. The whole thing to me, I found very, very strange. And also, you know, people are eating, all these things don't have any words of Torah. I've never quite understood that. Come to Toronto, very often people complain, you got 5 speeches at a wedding, 8 speeches at a wedding. You know, it's a whole different idea. But okay, that's just a personal pet peeve, which you can ignore of mine. But that's what the Mishnah says. Whenever people gather for a physical activity, we have to elevate it spiritually and say words of Torah. And then the Mishnah says, and then they quote the Pasuk, Kol Shulchanot Malukiyat Sawat. It's dirt and disgusting if you just eat and you don't acknowledge God. But if 3 people sit and they share words of Torah, it's a very wide, a beautiful idea. A distinction is if you're reading with God. You're reading from the table of God. It's not just it's a nice thing to do and it's a mitzvah. You become basically godly, which of course is the Salvation always swing. That's the key mitzvah of the Torah. The overarching mitzvah of the Torah is, as he would say, v'halachta bidrachav. We're going to read it, I think, in a couple of weeks. To walk in the ways of God. The same way God is merciful, we should be merciful. The same way God is kind. We're supposed to be kind. We're supposed to imitate God. And that really is why the story of creation is written in the Torah. The story of creation is not to tell us how the world was created, because the Torah does a really bad job at that, and it doesn't really explain anything, and that's why all the issues with the conflict between science and creation. The purpose of the story of creation is not to tell us how the world was created, tell us why the world was created. This is not our subject now. But Rosolovich, on one simple idea, said the story of creation teaches us the same way God is a creator, man has to be a creator. We have to imitate God. That's the overarching mitzvah. And everybody has their creative talents. Some people have creative talents in art and music and science and medicine, wherever your field is. And some people are creative in learning Torah. So everybody has to develop their creative talents. And it's no coincidence that the first mitzvah of the Torah is to have children. That's the highest act of creativity that one can possibly do. So that's the idea, that everything we do in our lives is supposed to be imitate God. So when we eat, we can join with God in eating. Okay, that's we can move on. Some Mishnah we can do more quickly, others. Okay, Mishnah Dalet. Rabbi Chanina ben Chaynai Omer, Haneor Belaila. So this is one who stays awake at night. I think, I don't know, I'm a night person. You know, I don't, I go to bed late and I don't like getting up early. And they are Belaila, v'hamalech b'derech yichidi, and one who walks alone, one who goes on the path alone, ha'mefaneh libo lebatala, one who turns his heart for meaningless things, harei zeh mitchayev b'nefsho, he's guilty of, he's worthy of a death penalty, he's mitchayev b'nefsho, he has to give up his soul. It's also probably an exaggeration. So what does that mean, Haneor Belaila? So what's wrong with staying up at night? And Hamahalech, so it's interesting. The commentaries basically assume it's the same thing, Malech b'derech. If you go alone, walking alone, and this the commentaries explain is even in the daytime. Even in the daytime, I have to see if it's still applicable nowadays. But it was dangerous. The derech in walking on the path, going somewhere was always, Yaakov told his children, Al Tirgazu B'derech, when they went down to Egypt, you know, Amalek attacked us in the derech. The word derech, very often in the Torah, has a very negative connotation. When people travel, the risks are higher, especially in the ancient times, but even today, we have a tefillah haderech. We say a special tefillah when we go somewhere, because that's considered more dangerous. So the idea that anybody would go anywhere alone at any time was very looked down upon. So that's what the Mishnah says. Whether this applies in a big city in the middle of the day, I don't, I have my doubts. I don't, we all go alone and et cetera. But it means not to go in the middle of nowhere. It's dangerous. And that's, like I say, the Torah equates derech with danger. It's interesting. We say Shema, v'shivtecha v'techa uvelech lecha baderech. When we're going on the way and there's a, we're learning Torah, there's a special, that serves as a protection, so to speak. When we're going on the derech, it's in a sense more important that we engage in the study of Torah. We'll come back to that in a few moments. So Haneor Balaila is also means a person's up and around that night, and that's considered dangerous. Could also mean the Rambam says that the purpose of night is to learn Torah. That Rambam has a striking statement, a little bit, you know, you read these statements like sometimes in our tradition, it's depressing a little bit, you know, like we have other ones that are very uplifting, but the Rambam says if one wants to become a Torah scholar, he has to spend all night. I mean, every night, but he has to learn. He can't even spend one night doing nothing. He can't go to a baseball game one night or go out who knows what for a nice dinner. I don't know what. I'm not sure exactly what the Rambam means in practice, but the Rambam, in describing the way to become, if you want to become, many people are not interested, but if you want to become a great Torah scholar, the way to do that is to study Torah at night. And people, the great Torah scholars, that's really probably is very true. It's quiet. You can focus. There are no interruptions. Just kind of like the same way people used to like to go to work early in the morning, at 7 a.m, before the phones ring, before other people in the office. Once people come in, it's hard to get any work done. Right. Sometimes the best time to do work is when it's quiet. So that could be a neir balayla. You're just staying up at night doing nothing. And hamefaneh libo lebatala, meaning you're wasting away. You're not doing anything important. It's the same idea. The same way eating has to be done with a sort of a spiritual idea. So too. All our activities that we do should have something, some higher goal than just sort of existing physically. Okay, the Mishnah continues on a sort of similar idea. So this is Rabbi Nechunya ben Hakana Omer. So basically what the theme, whoever accepts the yoke of Torah, we remove from him the yoke of kingdom and the yoke of derech eretz. So derech eretz, we know, is not an easy term to translate. We saw it before in the second chapter, the Yafet Talmud Torah im derech eretz, the famous slogan of Rav Shimshon Rafael Hirsch, that it's nice to have derech eretz and Torah. Derech eretz there, he interpreted as culture, as being involved in the world, worldly knowledge. It could also mean, well, you know, quote unquote manners, derech eretz, the ways of the world, working, different ideas. But whatever derech eretz means, here it seems like derech eretz has a slightly negative connotation. In other words, it's the opposite of Torah. In other words, if you accept Torah, you won't have to worry about derech eretz, which is why the commentaries explain it's really referring to earning a living, the worries that we have in life. Now, doesn't mean, at least I don't think it means, therefore if you learn, if you accept Torah, you don't have to worry about earning a living or livelihood or money's going to grow on trees. That's never been a Jewish attitude. But what I really think the Mishnah means is that everybody in life has things that, you know, are troublesome. We all have burdens. We all have issues that we have to deal. We all have worries that we have to deal in life. And the question is, what are your worries going to be? Are your worries going to be in the area of Torah, or are your worries going to be in making more money and in this problem? And we all know that when you have a larger problem, bigger, smaller problems go away. That's what's going on now. You know, COVID changed the world in so many ways, some of which hopefully will continue after, hopefully, you know, when this whole thing ends, please God, soon. Some will, hopefully a lot of things will that have changed will remain changed, because many of the changes have been actually quite positive. When we have a great problem, we relieve ourselves of smaller problems. And I think that's really what the Mishnah is getting at. If you focus your life on Torah, if you have an overarching goal in life, other issues don't bother you as much. Everybody who's focused on a goal, they don't let things bother them, because they're so, you know, razor focused on something. It's what Rav Soloveitchik explains, he has this in Al-Tshuva, when he writes a cute story that a psychiatrist came to him once and complained that we daven on Rosh Chodesh Elul, so they want to wish everybody a good Chodesh. Mm-hmm. A psychiatrist complained that we say in the davening on Yom Tov, on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, Chein Tein Pachdecha Hashem Elokeinu Al Kol Maasecha. God, give us pachad. Pachad is more than ema. Ema is awe. Yira is also awe. Yira doesn't mean to be afraid, like my knees are buckling. Like, we have to have Yirat Hashem and Yirat of our parents, Ishimova Vitiro. It doesn't mean fear, like we're afraid. It means awe. The word for being afraid is pachad, is you're trembling, you're really, really afraid. So why, he says it's very unhealthy. This is a terrible prayer to say, that fear, we know, neurosis, all the terrible things. Why would we pray to have fear of God, or even like real fear? I mean, on Rosh Hashanah, it's the idea that our life is hanging in the balance. That's why they use the word like, you know, pachad, and not just yira. We also use yira. So Rav Soloveitchik explained that a person who is afraid of God truly will have no other fears in life. Nothing else to worry about. A person's worried about, you know, where to go on vacation. And then, God forbid, they get like a terrible medical diagnosis. So the vacation sort of doesn't worry them anymore. And whenever you have a greater worry, the lesser worries go away. So that's what Rav Soloveitchik said, that we pray that our worry should be only towards God. If we're so focused on God, it clears us up. It's like if you work in a job and you only have to report to the CEO, that's a lot better than reporting to 8 middle managers. And that's a whole hierarchy. The closer you are to the top, you don't have to worry about what's below you because you're sort of in charge of them. So one who's focused only on God, who's in charge of everything, so you don't have to worry about anything else. It's I think it's a beautiful idea. Maybe it's not so easy to apply that always in practice. And I think that's what the Mishnah is saying. A person who's focused on the yoke, so to speak, of Torah will be able to deal with other problems, put it in perspective, understand that there's a purpose, that whatever happens in this world is not just by chance. And if we all know that people who have great faith, which is very hard to have to work on, it's not an easy thing. It makes life easier because you can deal with problems on a better area. But the Mishnah says, "Kol ha'parek mimenu ol Torah," a person who throws away the yoke of Torah, "Notnim alav omachut v'ol derech aretz." You can't live a life where you have no problems. Only dead people have no problems. People who are alive have problems. We said to explain a while ago, right? The punishment of the snake, that he's going to eat from the ground. What kind of punishment that is? He doesn't have to work, and everywhere he goes, he can eat. There's no problem. If you don't have to work for something, it's meaningless. When everything is given to you, on you, that's not a life worth waiting. That's the greatest punishment. That's a very important lesson for modern man. So you're always going to have issues. So don't think, but by throwing off the responsibilities the Torah demands of us, that you won't have other problems to take the place. Halavai, you know, your problem should be in the area of the Torah. That's what Rabbi Ziering was talking about on Sunday, that the famous story on Rabbi Akiva, you know, when he was put in jail and Papias said to him, "What are you doing in jail?" And he was in jail, you know, well, this guy's in jail because he's a crook. The other guy's in jail because he studied Torah. Well, that's a very different reason to be in jail, your attitude. Blessed is the person, we don't want to go to jail, but blessed is the person whose problems come because they study Torah for some noble purpose than some purpose that isn't. Okay. Any next Mishnah, Rabbi Chalafta Ish Kvar Chananya Omer, Asara Sheyoshvim Voski Mitor. So we're back to this idea. It's a very interesting Mishnah. The Mishnah basically says, if you sit and learn Torah, God is your partner, right? You know, Rav Soloveitchik used to, you know, he describes so beautifully. He would describe when he would learn, he would feel the presence of his father. You know, he could sort of, he would communicate with his father. Then the Rav describes that when he gave shir, says that you know, he would give a shir, and a quote on the Rambam would walk into the room, and the Rambam would make a statement, and then the Rambam would sit down, and the Ravid would stand up and start yelling at the Rambam, and this one came in, and then the Vilna Gaon came in, and the Shach and the Taz, and he would describe you know, only as Rav Soloveitchik could do in this beautiful language, how there's the voices of Torah from all the generations coming together. And he came into the shir as an old man, you know, an older man with young students, and he left the shir invigorated, feeling young. There's something, you feel the presence, well, he was talking about the presence of great Torah scholars, but that's the same idea, the presence of God, right? That's how Rabbi Akiva, you know, the famous Et story, that Rabbi Akiva would say that the Et in the Torah, every Et means something. Kaved Et Avicha, don't, you have to honor your older brother, not just your father, right? And every Et would mean something special until he came to Et Hashem Elokecha Tira, and you should fear God. He said, okay, the whole system is wrong. You can't compare anybody to God. So he said, Kishem Shekabel Scharal Hatrisha Kacha Kabel Scharal Hapresha. The same way I got reward for interpreting, I'll get reward for removing all my interpretation. In Hebrew, it's much better because it rhymes. The Trisha and the Presha. To analyze it, you know, what I first thought, and then to recant it. And then, no, Rabbi Kiva came along and said, Et Hashem Elokecha Tira means lirabot talmidei chachamim. This comes to include Torah scholars who are treated like, oh, we had that in Pirkei Avot. The mora, the fear of our teachers, or the awe, should be like the awe of heaven. So when one has the presence of great Torah scholars, it's like having the presence of God in a sense. We don't know what it means, really, the presence of God, right? We have to humanize always the presence of God so we can understand it. So the Mishnah says, if you're sitting and learning, and the presence of God will be you. And then the Mishnah goes through 10, 5, 3, 2, and 1. So on the one hand, the divine presence is dwelling among them. We know that 10 is a quote-unquote a minion. But by the way, without, I know this is opening up a little bit of a Pandora's box, a drop, but a minion, you're right. So whenever you say a minion is 10 people, so that's not really true. A minion is 10 men, right? But that's only true for tefillah. That's not true in other areas of halakha. Really? Probably not even on Megillat Esther. In other words, when we read Megillat Esther in public doesn't mean 10 men. I mean, it means 10 people. It means, or there's a mitzvah of Kiddush Hashem in the Torah. You have to sanctify God's name. So everybody knows that the big three, the three cardinal sins, idolatry, adultery, and murder, you have to give up your life. What is a little bit less well known, but it's in the same Rambam, and is that if the sin, it's not one of the big three, it's to eat a cheeseburger. But it's done, they make you eat the cheeseburger in public. Then you also have to give up your life. Parhesia. That was the Gemara's, you know, question. That's the Gemara said, how could Esther marry Achashverosh? It was in public. Everybody knew Esther. How could Esther marry? So the Tosa says, what kind of a weird question is that? Why don't they just say it's adultery? Kiloy Araya. Why do they have to say, but okay, we're not going to get into that. But you see from the Gemara's, you know, question, Parhesia being in public. So that does, what's public? A minion. But a minion doesn't mean 10 men. It means woman, right? It can mean man and woman. So 10 people who are studying Torah, I don't think means men. I mean, maybe in the Mishnah, the time of the Mishnah, women didn't, you know, not so many women were studying Torah. There were some. But it's only regards to Hilchot Tefillah, for other reasons, that a minion consists of only 10 men. But in all other areas, when we require public, women and men, I believe, are halachically are counted equally. But anyway, so the Mishnah says there are 10 people who are learning Torah, divine presence there. Elohim needs about that. And of course, what is always very worth pointing out, where do we derive a minion from? I'll let people type in. Where do we derive a minion from?
From the spies,
right? The spies in Korach, actually, also Ada and Ada. That it's so. Who we're deriving, right? There were 10 bad spies, if I can use the simple English, right? And two good spies, right? They're considered an Eidah, Admatai Leidah Hara'ah, this congregation. And how do we know Eidah comes from Korach? We need Ashti B'toch Adat Yisrael, whatever. And the Gemara derives that you need 10. But the fact is that it's 10 impious people. You know, people say, you only want a minion of observant Jews. What do you mean? The whole derivation of a minion. 10 Jews come together, even if they're constitute a minion. Okay, so, but then the Gemara in Michigan is, how do you know if it's true with 5? How do you know if it's true with 3? How do you know with 2? And how do you know it's 1? And the Gemara, each one quotes a pasuk, right? Elohim is up at that L, the congregation is 10. The one for 5 is very hard. Agudato alerit yisada. What exactly the aguda, gathering up together? The Eretz Yisrael just says simply, or not so simply, means a hand, an aguda, like the hand joined together, five fingers in the hand. It's interesting, the Bartanura switches the verses. He says, how do you know 5, the Kerev Elohim Yishpot? In other words, the Mishnah says, how do you know if 3 people are studying Torah, God is with them, the Shekhinah is with them. So they quote a pasuk, Bekerev Elohim Yishpot, God is with the judges. And we know that a court, a general court is 3. A court for a capital case is 23. But the normal disputes that come up, they're your run-of-the-day court, the courts that we have today consist of 3 people. Bekerev Elohim Yishpot. So the Bartanura says, no, that teaches us 5, not just 3, because you have 3 judges, but you have 2 litigants. So that makes 5 people. Mm-hmm. Of course, the other thing to point out is the Gemara in Sanhedrin says, you know, a court, a judge, well, he's not learning Torah. You're 2 people are arguing about some business deal, and they're cursing each other, and each guy's a low life, and you know how the fights can get when it comes to money. And they come to court, and are young. So the what kind of Torah is this? Well, you know, this is not Torah. So the Gemara says that this is the highest form of Torah. When a judge issues a proper judgment, he becomes a partner with God in the creation of the world. We don't say that when a person just learns some Gemara and we learn something, Daf Yomi Shir, you don't say become a partner with God. But you know, when you're a judge and you adjudicate a case, you become a partner. In other words, what's the purpose of Torah? It's peace. And a judge, when he issues a ruling to promote peace, to solve a problem, that's the highest form of Torah. That's putting Torah into practice. When I sit in the Beit Medrash, it's theoretical Torah. But when I'm sitting and a Beit Din, and I'm actually judging real like conflicts in the world between 2 people, that's in a sense the highest form of the Torah. People often don't feel, you know, I'm not really learning, I'm being only a judge. So in a sense, that's what the Mishnah is saying. No, even 3 people sitting in judgment, the divine presence is there, even though they're not technically learning Torah. The other psukim, well, I don't know necessarily refer to Torah, but then we quote by 2, Aznid Beru Yirei Hashem, Ish El Re'eyu, person speaking to another. And then we have, even if a person sits alone, God is with them. So if God is with you with 1, well, what do you need 10? So obviously it's not the same. God can be with you and God can be with you. In other words, 10, when the Mishnah could have said, how do we know that if a person sits and learns Torah by himself, God is with them? Quote a verse, good. So if God is with us with 1, he's for sure with us with 10. That's not what the Mishnah says. The Mishnah begins with 10, then it goes to 5, then it goes to 3, then it goes to 2, then it goes to 1. So each one is different. And each one has its place, like I was saying before. The classical way to learn is with a chavruta, to learn with somebody else, because you bounce off ideas. That's how you grow. But anybody will tell you, great people, scholars will tell you, sometimes they have to learn alone also. They need to focus on their own. You can't always learn with a chavrusa. Sometimes your best learning is done when you're thinking fully by yourself. But so there's the highest level of 10 going down to 5. Good. So we know it's interesting that 5 gets in as a number. Another, I know 10 is a minion. 3 is a mezumin. 2 is okay. 2 people sharing Torah. 1 person is learning Torah. So it's interesting the idea that 5, in a sense, gets its own number. But that's a special idea. I don't know of any area in halacha that I can think of offhand where 5 plays a role. We know 10 plays a role, 3 plays a role, 2 plays a role in witnesses, 1 even plays a halakhic role. In other words, most witnesses, it's good with one person. And we say you need 2 people to be a witness. That's true in a court case when there's but it's not true in ritual law. You only need 1 person to say the food. You only need 1 mashgiach to say the food is kosher. You only need 1 woman at the mikveh to say that the going into the mikveh was done correctly, right? One person is good enough, you know, testimony, even in ritual law. And 2 people have a role, as, you know, in other cases, you need 2 witnesses, and 3 people have a role, it's a mezumen, and 10 people have a role, it's a minyan or public. And when you don't need a minyan, it still serves as the public. I don't know why 5. I'm not, if somebody knows, I don't know of any area of halakha that I can think of where 5 plays a role. Okay, I throw that out with you. Fine. Okay, let's continue. We're covering more ground than usual today. Maybe good, I don't know. Rabbi Elazar Ish Bar Tuta Omer. Tein lo mishlo. By the way, what I haven't done so much, many of these people who I quoted, you know, often I like to give you, like last week, you spent half an hour on Akavi Ben Mahalo, because I love him, and, you know, the famous Mishnah about him is intellectual honesty. Many of these people quoted here are quoted very rarely. I also know less about them, because they're quoted rarely. Rav Nachunya Ben Hakana is a famous Mishnah that you're supposed to make a prayer when you come in to learn and when you leave to learn. Okay, but fine. In other words, when you go into the Beit Medrash, you were supposed to pray that you'll be successful, and when you leave, that you didn't make any mistakes. But I think I mentioned in the first class we had, I believe there are 22 of the rabbis in Pirkei Avot are mentioned nowhere else but Pirkei Avot, which is a fascinating idea, because Pirkei Avot is very different and people specialize. So many of the teaching, they're not legal like teachings, they're moral and ethical teachings. So you have people who specialize. The truth is, you have people who specialized in halakhic areas too. And you have certain, like, sages are quoted only in certain areas. It's like we have today. Today, everybody's a specialist. You know, you go to, so people, it's very hard to know everything. Anyways, so Rav Elazar Ish Bar Tuta says, and the reason they say Ish Bar Tuta is not the regular Rav Elazar we have all the time. Tein lo mishalo, give to him, give to God. Shata v'shocha shalo. Everything belongs to God. Okay, everything you have, everything that you have, you should use in the service of God. Now, that's also a wonderful opportunity. What it means is everything we have can be used in service of God, right? That's what it means. I was brought up to be an observant Jew means that we can serve God not only through this, of course, through the study of Torah and observance of mitzvot, but through the study of physics, right? You study God. Through the study of nature, we can study God. All knowledge comes from God, any form of knowledge. Rav Lichtenstein spoke so often, wrote often how, you know, his study of English literature enriched his appreciation of Tanakh, appreciation of Judaism. Anything you learn can be used in a way to grow. But it's not only learning, not only intellectual, how you play sports. I have a friend who always used to say, you can tell a lot about a person by how they drive. Do they cut you off on the highway? Do they go through that light as it turns red? You can learn a lot about a person. Everything you have in life, you can use to service God. Of course, money goes without saying. How you use your money, wisdom, strength. The Tiferet Yisrael quotes a whole bunch. Interesting, he quotes wealth, strength, wisdom, memory. And then he quotes this, now we're coming, we're Rosh Chodesh Elul, so I thought, a beautiful voice. It says, if one has a beautiful voice, use it in the service of God. So it means be a chazan, but I don't know, it doesn't mean a necessarily professional chazan, but it means everything you do, everything you have can be done. And of course, a beautiful voice, I'm sure he meant it, you know, you have a beautiful voice as a nice chazan, but a beautiful voice can also mean how you speak to people. A beautiful voice, a mannerism of speaking. So that's what it means. It's not just everything we do we should give to God. It means everything we do, we can use it in the service of God. And of course, using it in the service of man is also the service of God, right? Remember, man is created in the image of God. So whenever we help man, we're helping God. It's not going to be sit around all day, oh my God, you know, thinking about God, like, you know, it's only for God. No, if you help people benefit from it, that's also serving God. It's not like you're not allowed to enjoy it. That's not what he's saying at all. It means everything you have should be done for a noble purpose. And that includes so many things, because everything you do, everything in this world belongs to God. That's the other reason the story of creation is written in the Chumash, right? Not to tell us how the world was created, that God is the owner. That's the first Rashi in Chumash, right? Our right to the land of Israel is because God owns the world. And God, right, that's what Rashi says, famous Rashi, right? That, right? It doesn't work in the UN, and nor I went into the I think it was Abba Ibn, when I think it was him. Maybe it was even Netanyahu. When Netanyahu, for those who remember many years ago, Netanyahu started off, he was the Israeli ambassador to the UN. And I think one of them held up this Rashi in the UN, you know, on one of the debates about Israel, and said, you know, many of the countries in the UN, they're all claimed they're religious. The Muslims are all religious, you know, or Christian, they accept the Bible. So it says in the Bible right here, God created everything. No, that's not the, that's a cute gimmick, but it's not really going to work. It's for us to know. It's really, Rashi wasn't talking, I don't think, to the nations of the world. Rashi was talking to Jewish people, that we should know we have a God-given right to Israel. That has nothing to do with the political, what the giving back, it has nothing to do with anything. Just has to do, even whatever, we should know that we have, in theory, a God-given right to Israel. So maybe we can use it in practice, maybe we can't. Okay, so anyways, everything we have in this world belongs to God. That's what the Torah tells us. Rabbi Shimon Omer, this we alluded to once before, a beautiful Mishnah. Some say it's Rabbi Yaakov, whatever. Hamalach baderach. A person's walking on the way, the shoneh, and he's learning. That's what he said before. Belachtecha baderach. You have to learn when you go on the pathway you're supposed to learn. Bishinanta levenecha. By the way, this has come up a little bit also in Rabbi Ziering's, you know, series on the Shema. It's not so clear there's a biblical obligation to say Shema. I know this is very, very striking sometimes when people first hear that, because everybody knows b'shofucha uvkumecha, when you go to bed, when you get up, you have to say Shema. But that's not really what the verse is talking about. The simple reading of the verse, it's talking about the study of Torah. B'avta Hashem Elokecha b'chol levavcha, you have to love God. B'shinamtam levanecha, you should teach your children. B'shinam levedibarta b'am, and speak in Torah, speak in words. B'shivtecha v'veitecha, when you're in our home. B'lechecha b'derech, b'shofcha u'kumecha. It's talking about the study of Torah. It's not talking about Shema. The rabbis then interpreted it to understand on a secondary level of interpretation that then, according to some, but not according to all, became a biblical law to recite Shema, right? When the rabbis interpret a verse in the Torah, so you, if they're saying this is what the verse really means, that becomes part of the biblical law. According to the Rambam, you can't count that as one of the 613 mitzvot, right? According to the Rambam, you can only count one of the 613 mitzvot, something that's written directly in the Torah. But if the rabbis derive it, like the 39 melachot are not part of the 613 mitzvot. There's one mitzvah not to do melacha on Shabbat, because that's what it says in the Torah. But how do we know I can't cook and I can't plow and I can't thresh and I can't hunt? That's not written anywhere in the Torah. It's derived. The rabbis derive it. So we consider that derivation to be a biblical source, but it's not one of the 613 mitzvot. That's the first principle, the second principle in the Rambam, when he writes the Sefer HaMitzvot, when he classifies the 613 mitzvot. The first principle is you don't count rabbinic law. The second principle is you don't count things that are derived from a rabbinic interpretation, even though the rabbinic interpretation may be a biblical value, a biblical importance. It's not quite the same thing as something written in Torah. Something written in Torah can never change. It's really the simple explanation of the Rambam. It's true, the Torah can never change, but that's only the written Torah. Interpretations of Torah can always change. Mm-hmm. We today don't have the power to change the Torah. That's what it sort of means to be an Orthodox Jew. We don't have the power to reinterpret what the Talmud interpreted. But when there will be a Sanhedrin, they will have that power. And it happened very often in the Gemara, that one court, you have it in the Mishnah, the early Beit Din interpreted the Torah law like this. And we say, no. When the Torah says this, it means something else. So there's, it's not written in stone. I know this sounds almost heretical, but it's not written in stone that there have to be 39 forbidden categories of work on Shabbat. It's been written in stone for the last few thousand years, and we can't change it. To be an observant Jew means we accept that. We accept the authority of the Talmud. We cannot argue on it. However, in theory, that could be changed by a future day Sanhedrin. This requires, of course, much more discussion. And that's why the Rambam is so insistent on distinguishing between things that are written in the Torah itself, that's the word of God, that can never, ever, ever change, or things that are interpreted in the Torah. So only things that are directly written in the Torah can become a mitzvah. Anyways, the Rambam does count the saying of Shema. How do you interpret what it means? Anyways, that's just an aside. But that's what it said. You're walking on the street. So obviously, what else are you going to do when you go on the street except to learn? Yeah, I mean, people are walking and they're discussing learning. I mean, there are other things I can think of. But umafsik mimishnato, when he stops learning, how beautiful is this tree, mane and nirzeh, how beautiful nature, it's so beautiful. So that's a nice thing to do. You're appreciating God's nature. Male alav hakatuv, the Torah considers it as if, ke'ilu, back to this word ke'ilu again, it's not that same thing, ke'ilu mitchayev b'nafsho, it's as if he's guilty of a capital offense and he's worthy of death. It's like, whoa. A guy's learning Torah, he's walking on the street, and he stops. You see that beautiful sunset. Wow, look at the moon. It's such a clear moon today. That's mitchayev b'nafsho. And you say, ma rabu masach Hashem. We said it this morning in Baruch Nafshi, Rosh Chodesh. Ma rabu masach Hashem. How beautiful are God's creation. And the Bar Tanura says, even if you make a bracha, there is, you know, in Nisan, for example, quotes another bracha, you see the first trees blossom, you make a blessing. So what do you mean? That's, he's doing a wonderful thing. So the classical interpretation of Bershim, yeah, it's all wonderful, but not when you're learning Torah. This is wow. When you learn Torah, nothing can interrupt the study of Torah. So even though saying that how beautiful God are your creation, that this is a beautiful tree, it's a nice thing to do. It's a nice thing to do when shiur's over. You don't do it in the middle of learning. So I don't know. Maybe I don't want to learn. I'm afraid I can't live up to such a high level. Okay, I don't think that's ke'ilu. I don't think he's saying you should have learned because of that. But so that's the classical interpretation. I mentioned many weeks ago, I don't know if it was here, I mentioned in another context, that of course, Rav Shishman Feller Hirsch has a beautiful interpretation here. He turns the Mishnah on its head, turns the traditional interpretation. This is what I mean. We can always reinterpret things. When I just said we can't argue on the Talmud's interpretation, that's in halachic matters, right? When it comes to Agadah, we can always argue that. The Abar Benel says, I mean, that's a whole other discussion. The distinction between legal matters that we have to accept the authority of Talmud and then opinions, who wrote this book in Tanakh and that's already midrashim. That's a whole different, genre. And many of the, not all, some said no, that has to be accepted also 100%. Rav Aaron Cutler, for example, held that view. But other people held other views that no. And many of the earlier commentaries, and look in the Tosfot Yontif, it is Nazir and the Mishnah, all over the place, the Gaonim. And we don't have to accept the authority of the Talmud in non-legal matters. But again, that's a further discussion. But that's really not directly connected here. But interpretations, new interpretations are always welcome. That's the beauty of why we learn all the time. New interpretations. But Rav Shimshon Frohlich Hirsch's interpretation turns the mission on its head. He said, the problem is not that you stop, that you said this is a beautiful tree. The problem is, hamafsik mimishnato. He stopped learning to say it's a beautiful tree. In other words, if the beautiful tree is part of your learning, that's great. When a person sees a distinction, I'm learning and I stop my learning to say this is a beautiful tree. That's terrible. But if I'm learning and as part of my learning, I say, let's learn about God's beautiful creation of nature. That's exactly what Torah is. So to say it's a beautiful tree is part of, it's what I was saying before, like physics, chemistry, mathematics, that can be all part of learning. How do we view it? That we view it as part of our worship of God. If you view it, it's not connected to Torah. It's separate. So I don't know about that, but right, that's not good. That's what Rav Shimshon Frohlich Hirsch say. If you view nature, if you view the beauty of nature, not part of your learning, if you're mafsik mimishnato, in order to say it's a beautiful tree, that's mitchayev b'nafsho. But if you incorporate it into your learning, that's a beautiful thing. And of course, this obviously coming from Rav Shimshon Frohlich Hirsch, this of course fits in beautifully with his whole view of life, Torah in Derech Eretz, that nature, science and culture, it's all part of God. I, somebody told me maybe the story isn't true. But even if it isn't true, right, we always know you can't believe all the stories you hear. Or you shouldn't believe them either, all of them. But I had heard that that Shishrael Hirsch always took in his school in Frankfurt. They went on a school trip. They would go, I guess, maybe, I don't know, it was the graduating class or also, I don't know who exactly, to the Swiss Alps. And I've never been to the Swiss Alps, mind you. And he was criticized, you know, taking time from learning to go to the Swiss Alps is not what you do in a yeshiva. So he said, what do you mean? This is God's creation. And when he comes to heaven, God's going to ask him, the Yerushalmi says that one of the questions God is going to ask us after 120 years is, did you enjoy my world? I created a beautiful world for you, for your benefit. God created the man, Olam Chesed Yibaneh. It was an act of kindness for God to create the world. So how can we not benefit from this world? So how can I not go and see the Swiss Alps? The Swiss Alps is part of learning. Whether the story is true or not, I don't know, but it could be true. In other words, the story represents an idea, but that's and that's really how it's brought up. Learning physics is part of, can be part of creation. It's interesting, by the way, and I'm just throwing this out into the side. In all, I don't know what word you want to use, in traditional yeshivot, of course, even those that take the general studies, you know, seriously, they always make a clear distinction between Torah study and general studies. In other words, they'll have Gemara in the morning. The feeling is, I don't know if it's really true for everybody, but the more important stuff you do right away in the morning, Limudei Kodesh till lunchtime, and then after lunch, you do Limudei Chol. But that's how Yeshiva University works, and that's how Norman Lam, Mark Shapiro was talking about this not so long ago when he wrote a letter to Norman Lam. You know, he's discussing, as I mentioned all the time, for those who haven't been there, he's discussing his latest book. He's been discussing it now for over 2 months, but he wrote over 30 years letters to all kinds of rabbinic authorities, from the right to the left, everything really. I don't know anybody who wrote to such a wide, diversity of Torah scholars. So one of the letters he wrote to Norman Lam was, Norman Lam, who, you know, believed Torah Mada and the importance of general studies. Should you make a bracha, a birchas Torah, if you study physics, right? And in theories, they're bricha in physics. And Norman Lam said no, but Mark said he doesn't understand why not. If you consider physics to be part of God's creation, part of the study of Torah, you could maybe make a bricha Torah on that. But whatever, that's a whole other thing. But you could argue, it's not, in other words, I think what people will argue is that even as important as general studies are, and even as important as saying a beautiful tree is, it's still not the same. It's not the same as Torah. There's still Torah texts, and there are other things that are part of Torah, but there's a hierarchy within the system. Okay, I hear that. But if you take this to its nth degree, so I mean, a school should really have a totally integrated curriculum, which some of the modern Orthodox schools do have. Now, they may do that for scheduling reasons. I'm not sure they're doing it for Hashkavrit, because if you want a teacher to teach full-time and all the schools have only Hebrew in the morning, then the teacher can only work half day. That's a problem, right? You know, you want a teacher to be able to teach. Anyways, but it could also be ideologically, if you truly, truly believe that physics and chemistry is just an expression, a practical Torah, and you're studying it from a religious bent. Remember, Shimshon Val Hirsch would not hire a non-observant Jew to teach mathematics or to teach German, because that's just part of Torah. I don't want, that's not the Yeshiva University approach. Yeshiva University approach, hire a non-Jew, hire whoever, who cares? Who cares? They're teaching, maybe as a student, we're supposed to see physics as a manifestation of God's world, but it doesn't come across like that when you teach it. But according to Hirsch, you'd have to have an observant teacher to teach all these subjects, because this too is Torah. So that's interesting. So maybe you want to have a integrated curriculum, because you truly believe that Torah has many subjects. There's Mishnah, there's Talmud, there's mathematics and physics and Navi, and they're all part of understanding God's Torah. Not the traditional way it's understood, but depends how far you want to go. Anyway, that's how Shimshon Raphael Hirsch explained it. Now, this Ke'ilu, right? Again, even if the classical Meforshim understand that, like I said, you're learning Torah and you stop, even though it's beautiful, you want to say it's a nice tree, not when you're learning Torah. Learning Torah is separate. You cannot say it's a beautiful tree when you're learning Torah. That's when you finish. Okay, so that's pretty two very different interpretations of the Mishnah, like I said. But even that first opinion, it's as if, so I mentioned earlier, and I mentioned the example of embarrassing somebody, ki'ilu, right? It's a person who embarrasses somebody, it's as if he killed him. So normally the word ki'ilu, it's as if, but as if doesn't mean it's equal. It's like, but it's not the same. But the truth of the matter is, I will point out that this is, again, like in Ripley's Believe It or Not, you know, like the more you learn, you come across opinions and you sort of, you scratch your head and say, wow, like unbelievable. The Binyan Sion, the truth of the matter, it's based on a Tosfot. When I first discovered this and I learned this, I looked up, it's actually based on a Tosfot in Sota, but the Binyan Sion, Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, who was the Rebbe of Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, one of the teachers of Shimshon Raphael Hirsch in Germany. He died, I believe, in 1898. No, I'm not sure when he died. Hirsch died in 1888. Whatever, he's in the 19th century. Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, he probably died earlier. But anyways, Rav Yaakov Ettlinger has a tshuva, halacha lemaisa, like a response is not like in the Kol book, response is like a practical question. And he was asked about if you have to give up your life rather than embarrass somebody, like how Tamar was willing to give up her life not to embarrass Yehuda. And the rabbis have a statement, it's better to get thrown into a fiery furnace than to embarrass somebody in public. So most people understand that that's like an exaggeration. Talmud doesn't mean it literally. That's how almost all the classical commentaries understand it. The rabbis speak in hyperbolic terms. Everybody does it. You want to make a point, so you stress it. Doesn't mean it in practice. And the Binyan Sion says, no, yes, it does. That a person has to give up their life rather than embarrass somebody in public. So that's like mind-boggling. I don't think that's the accepted view. At least it's for sure not done that way in practice. But that's an example of it's using ki'ilu as if as to be sort of exactly the same. But anyway, the idea is nature is part of Torah, but it's distinct from Torah in a sense. That's what the Mishnah says. And that, of course, continues. It's in the same Mishnah. The Mishnah began, give everything to God, right? That's how we began the Mishnah. Your wisdom, your good voice, your wealth, everything you've done can be done in the service of God. Of course, nature can be done in the service of God, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's the same as learning Torah. The truth of the matter is, again, this is another for really another time and more discussion and more, like critical analysis. Within Torah, there's a hierarchy of what to learn. In other words, today you ask most great rabbis, they'll tell you Gemara is the most important thing to learn, right? Look at the curriculum of any yeshiva. They ignore Tanakh in many yeshivas. Jewish philosophy, they don't study. In other words, there's a hierarchy. The Talmud itself says that a person should spend one third of their time in Tanakh, one third of their time in Mishnah, which basically means law. It means a simple law without analysis, and one third of their time in Gemara. War means analysis, debating, discussion, but not necessarily practical application, the process. So already Tosfot says, yeah, but the Talmud Bavli, the word Bavli means Balul, mixed up. It's all mixed together. So when you study Talmud, you get Tanakh too. You get everything by learning Talmud. That was the Ashkenazic practice, right? To learn in Yemen and other countries, they did put more stress on Torah Shabbat. And there are different things. I can tell you there are yeshivas where they'll throw you out if you study. I know people who told me they went to yeshiva and they would like to learn, Chumash for an hour a day, and they were told they can't learn Chumash here. I mean, it's sort of an amazing thing. But that's because the feeling is that within learning, so there's a hierarchy. So obviously there's going to be a hierarchy between learning and physics. But that's interesting. I mean, again, is that really correct? Because in other words, shouldn't all manners of learning be the same? In other words, in the Torah, to teach Torah, there's no distinction. Rabbi Avadya Yosef, of course, felt very strongly that he was not a fan of Daf Yomi. He felt if you only have an hour a day to learn, you should learn halacha, should learn how to practice what you do in practice. Problem is, people aren't going to do that, but whatever. So it's, that's a fascinating question, is when you're learning, what's the most important thing to learn? And my views have changed over time, and you know, and who are you teaching? Adults, children, kids, what's the goal? Is it important they understand text? Is why do Pirkei Avot and not do Gemara, you know, Baba Metzia? So yeah, it's right, everything has its place. So that's a fascinating discussion. I will say the Gemara says that a person learns only what they want to learn from. In other words, you should learn what you're interested in, because what you're interested in is what you're going to learn more of. So that's a good approach. Okay. Then the Gemara says like this. This is a little scary. So the next Mishnah. By the way, let me add just an important point, and this I will leave the next Mishnah till next week. You can't, the same way I can't interrupt my learning to praise a tree, let's say, or I can't interrupt learning to study physics, even though that may be part of learning, right? I can't interrupt something else to learn. In other words, I can't interrupt my davening to learn Torah. In other words, you're not allowed, this is a big problem. This should be the biggest problem we have. But you're not allowed to learn, you're not allowed to take out a Gemara in Chazaret HaShatz. I'm not talking about taking out a cell phone and texting your friend. That I'm not talking about. Take out a Gemara and learn. And lots of people do that. Lots of Talmidei Chachamim. Davening, that's Shleppi, and they're much more interested in learning. The Hasidim were interested in davening. The Mishnagdim wanted to learn all day. So they would interrupt the davening. So that's also not allowed. In other words, it's not, when you're doing something, do it properly. When you're learning, learn when you daven, daven. Rav Soloveitchik, I'll try saying very quickly because it's 10:27. Rabbi Soloveitchik beautifully explains, really such a beautiful idea, that learning and davening are opposite mitzvot. Maybe I mentioned this before. Learn, only a child can daven and only an adult can learn. Only a child can daven. Davening means total dependence. Why do I pray? Because I can't do it myself. I ask God to help me. God help me with wealth and help and wisdom and understanding, etc. Davening means I'm dependent on other people. Only children have that feeling. Adults are too cynical, too mature, too, you know, we got everything, too arrogant. Davening needs the mindset of a child. The Kruvim were children, right? But learning is the exact opposite. Learning, it needs critical analysis. I don't accept you. I argue with you. I'm yelling at you. You're an idiot. What are you talking about? Right? Learning needs an adult mind, and davening needs trials. But like an infant just cries out to the mother. That's how we davening. Crying is a form of a prayer. Like a child, totally dependent on their mother. But learning is the total opposite. I remember Rav Soloveitchik saying, and if you say, how do you know? My Rebbe told me. That's no answer. If you don't understand what your Rebbe said, don't tell me what your Rebbe said. You have to understand it. So davening and learning are two totally opposite mitzvot, which would explain the halakha, why it's forbidden to learn, not only while you daven, it's forbidden to learn just before you daven. Because if you're in the middle of a Tosfot and you close the Gemara to daven, your mind's thinking about what you're, hopefully, I mean, I don't know, your mind's thinking about what you're learning, and the halacha in theory, again, this should be our biggest problem, that you learn before you daven. But the halacha wanted your mind free from learning. You need a totally different mindset when you learn and when you daven. So the interruptions go both ways. You're not allowed to interrupt Torah, but you're not allowed to, or if a person's doing a mitzvah, if you're visiting somebody in the hospital, right? You're going to a wedding. You can't say, oh, I'm going to learn Torah here. What do you mean? No, you're doing a mitzvah, because that's Torah in practice. So when you're doing a practical mitzvah Torah, you can't interrupt that mitzvah to study Torah. Okay, let's very quickly review what we learned today. So we learned today that three people have to, when you eat together, you have to make words of Torah. Benching, baby, what you do has to be done in the spirit of God. Nighttime is for learning. You shouldn't go out alone at night. You shouldn't go out everywhere. The derech is a dangerous way. That's where Amalek said, came to attack us. We all have problems in life. Do we want our problems to be for a beautiful goal? You know, we have to work hard for a beautiful goal. Or do we want our problems to be mundane problems that just really have no something good to it, right? So our problems should be in the area of Torah. 10, 5, 3, 2, 1. Each one has its own place. God is with us when we study Torah. Everything we do, our beautiful voices, our wisdom should be done in the service of God and everything, even saying the beautiful tree. Maybe there's a time for it. It's part of what we say, but everything should be done in its proper time, learning, but everything should be done as an appreciation of God. Okay, let me just quickly, I see there are a couple questions here, and let me see what they're asking. In as a minion which requires women to make up the magic number of Pandora's box. I don't know. I said it, I'm opening up Pandora's box. Okay, whatever. I was just saying that the minion, of course, is only for men, for davening. Somebody sent me a private comment. If minion is 10 impious people, what do you do? Call Nidre preamble. We are allowed to daven with Avaryanim. Okay, very good. That's a good question. We say on Yom Kippur, we're allowed to daven with the sinners. At the same time, the Talmud says that on a fast day that doesn't have sinners is no fast day. The chelbana of the spices in the Ketoret had 11 spices. 11 spices. One of them smelled really bad. But when it was put with the other 10 beautiful smelling spices, it smelled good. And the Talmud says that represents a sinning Jew. You can't come to a shul without sinners. You can't have a minion of only Shomer Shabbos people. You have to have people, whatever sin you want to use. Maybe that's not a good example. Whatever. You have to have a minion, not people. At the same time, it is true that obviously God, we say that God heard the prayers of Yitzchak and not Rivka. It's a difficult Rashi, but a tzaddik ben a tzaddik. There is more. A righteous person's prayer are heard more. We can count the non-person. Don't think the non-religious person can't be counted. That's what some people say. Try to get a minion of observant Jewish people who pay their taxes. They're honest. They don't take revenge. They don't talk a lot of Lashon Hara. Try to get a minion of 10 people like that if you can find them. And then add on the people who are not. But both are true. Okay, if driving is an indicator, then the Swiss must be far from her. I don't know how the Swiss drive. Like I said, I've never been to Switzerland. I was never in the Swiss Alps, so I don't know. But okay, the Rambam of the five corners of the beard. Thank you very much. I said I didn't know what the number five is, the five corners of the beard. Okay, I'm not sure that counts, but thank you for that comment. Yes, very good. Okay, you know what? I'm going to put here, if you haven't filled out the survey yet, I sent yesterday, hold on a minute. A survey that a number you filled out. Very nice. Take you 1 minute. If you could just click on the link, that would be great. It'll literally take you 1 minute. We'd appreciate that just so we can sort of, as we move forward, I want to thank everybody, wish everybody a Shabbat Shalom, a wonderful day. Sunday morning, Rabbi Ziering is finishing his series on Kriyat Shema. Next week, we got four classes in our Tanakh series left. Please join in the, hopefully next week we'll announce our sort of Elo program pre-Rosh Hashanah. Everybody's, if you have any ideas or suggestions, now's the time. I have a number of things confirmed, but we're still, you know, not everything is etched in stone yet. So I'm happy to hear you and what anybody have to say. When I wish everybody well. And if anybody wants to talk, you can unmute yourself. You will be able to speak. Okay, thank you. Shabbat Shalom and Chodesh Tov. Please go. We'll see you next week.
Rabbi, number, yes? Five, number five, near the beginning of Sanhedrin, yes, there are five judges.
For you're right. There are certain cases where there are five judges. You are correct. Thank you for pointing that out. I forgot that. I appreciate that. Correct. Egla Ruf, I think, the Gemara mentions a couple cases where they set five judges. But you're right. But I don't think in modern times, yeah, but yes, thank you very much for that. The first mission in Sanhedrin, you are correct.
I'm not satisfied with that,
honestly. No, you learn the most from your students. That everybody knows. You always learn the most from your students. Thank you.